Please be seated. It is an honor, privilege, and deep joy to be here this morning back in this beloved community. And I'd be remiss if I did not begin by offering my gratitude to Patrick for the invitation to step once more on this holy ground as preacher. Now, I must admit, I find this to be a rather overwhelming occasion. The lessons this morning are deep and powerful, containing more than can ever be covered in a single sermon. And not only are these lessons rich and deep, these are lessons about liberation. Liberation rooted in the true meaning of love and the true meaning of community. Lessons, particularly our lesson from Acts, that are clear about the call for the liberation of those on the margins of society and the worshiping community, but particularly those who are foreigners, people of color, and members of the LGBT community. I find myself overwhelmed by the depth and magnitude of God revealed in these lessons. But that is not all that I am overwhelmed by this morning. Yesterday, a mere 24 hours ago, my theological world was shaken. Yesterday morning, one of the greatest theological giants of our day died, becoming one of the ancestors joining the communion of saints. The Reverend Dr. James Howe Cone was and is one of my favorite theologians, and his work has had a greater influence on my life than nearly any other theologian across the generations. It was not until I met Dr. Cone, contained in ink and paper, until I read his works, that I truly understood the purpose of theology or what it means to be a Christian. I know some of you have felt the transformative power of Cone's work as well. It was only a few years ago that we read together The Cross and the Lynching Tree, what would ultimately be his final book published during his lifetime. I find myself overwhelmed to stand in the shadow of this theological and spiritual giant tasked with preaching lessons of life, love, and liberation. But yet, there's still one more thing. Not only do we have these lessons, not only is this the first day in this new post-James Cone world, but we are here in this community. Well, my theological mind was open as I read the works of Dr. Cone. It was in this very place that for the first time I experienced his theology incarnate in community. Cone once wrote, "Any theology that is indifferent to the theme of liberation is not Christian theology." This is a community that has made incarnate this Christian theology that is synonymous with the concerns of liberation. From the very beginning, this has been a place concerned with the welcome, inclusion, and support of the poor, of women, people of color, the gay and lesbian community, and most recently, those who are transgender. I find myself overwhelmed by the lived Christian theology embedded in the very fibers of this community. The lessons appointed for this morning are familiar and run the risk of being sentimentalized. When we hear from the epistle, from the first letter of John, we can find ourselves thinking about those warm, fuzzy feelings of love, those feelings that are something like cake, puppies, and kittens, and miss out on the power and model of God's unceasing, never giving up, sacrificial, willing to be betrayed, tortured, and killed example of love. When we hear that great moment of liberation in the story of Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, we can reduce it to nothing more than a nice story of evangelism and miss out on the earth-shattering, boundary-defying, oppression-breaking nature of the call of God and the risk of discipleship. And when we hear Jesus say that I am the vine and you are the branches, our minds can drift to those nice little plaques, wall hangings, and garden decorations that reduce the very words of God to catchphrases without recognizing what it truly means to be branches, what it means to be community in a Lone Ranger sort of world. Love. That is what this passage from the first letter of John is all about. But what is love? It seems to me that love is one of the most overused and undervalued words in our English language. We love everything from the frivolous to the profound. So when we hear these words from the beginning of our epistle, we must pay close attention to what sort of love is actually being talked about. If God is love, if the very definition and identity of God is love, then we must reevaluate our definition of love so that we do not end up establishing a false equivalence of our favorite dessert or television program and God. The love of God, the love that is God, is the initiating force of the entire universe. It is out of love that God creates the heavens and the earth. It is out of love that God breathes over the waters of creation. It is out of love that God takes on human flesh and is born in the person of Jesus. It is that life-animating, sacrificial love that God dies a human death on the cross, that we might not only understand what it means to love and to be loved, but that we might finally and fully have life. This godly and holy love is not an abstract emotion or idealist theory. It is action lived concretely. We only understand love by experiencing God's love in our lives and in the world around us. By experiencing God's love reflected in the love we have for each other. And in order to know the love of God, we must live the love of God. We must live our lives the very same way that love did, following the model and example of Jesus. So that means loving those whom the world deems unlovable. That means valuing that which dominant culture deems worthless. That means loving because God first loved us and never the other way around. This passage forces a head-on confrontation with the fear that divides and separates people who exist together on the earth. For it makes clear that if we dare to claim that we love God, we must be bold enough to love those the world calls us to hate. For love and hate cannot stand together. So look at the world around us, it seems to be governed by fear. Fear of outsiders, fear of those who are different than us, fear of those who look differently, sound differently, love differently, understand differently. So we put up walls, figurative and literal. We create barriers. We cast people out of the community. If we allow ourselves to be the full recipients of God's love that God created us to be, then the power of that love will eradicate all fear we have of everything and everyone in the world around us. We will have the courage to be people of love and not people of fear. When we allow this perfect love to cast out our fear, that is when the kingdom breaks in. And that's exactly what we witness in the story of Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. Philip has experienced the transforming power of God's love and has responded by dedicating his life to the service of sharing and spreading that love to the very ends of the world. Philip is so filled with the love of God that he has no reason to fear. And in fact, even more than that, he has every reason to trust. So when God says to Philip, get up and go. Get up and go to unexpected and possibly even unwelcome places. Philip gets going. This journey, this wilderness road Philip is setting out on will take him to a place he never intended to go, and it will require of him that he enter into a relationship with someone he would never have met otherwise. In this story, we witness the power of God's love lived out in action. And we see someone experiencing the full, unfiltered love of God for the very first time. At the beginning of this passage, we meet a second character who is just as important in this story as Philip. Now, for someone who is unnamed, we actually know quite a lot about this Ethiopian eunuch. He was a court official of the Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. He was in charge of her entire treasury. He was on his way home from worshiping in Jerusalem, riding in his chariot and reading the prophet Isaiah. Now, the fact that this man was an Ethiopian tells us that he was a foreigner and a person of color different from those around him. The fact that this man is a eunuch tells us that he is considered a sexual outcast and minority. It tells us that following the Deuteronomic law, he would not have been allowed to be a full member of the worshiping community in Jerusalem or elsewhere. And the fact that he is a eunuch and a court official tells us that he is the perfect servant, because he does not present a threat to the purity of the royal bloodline. It tells us that his body can be used to move through gendered spaces in a way that others cannot. And as a court official and a person of some wealth, at least with enough means to have his own copy of Isaiah, we know that he would have been accused of having the wrong type of job, of having allegiance to the wrong master. Literally, every detail about this Ethiopian eunuch tells us that the dominant culture of his day, the institutions of secular and sacred authority, would have labeled him as other, a person on the margins, not worthy of full inclusion, not worthy of his full personhood, not worthy of the full measure of the love of God. When Philip arrives on that wilderness road, when he sees this Ethiopian eunuch, God's love is being incarnate through Philip's actions. God, through Philip, is chasing after the Ethiopian eunuch, begging and desiring to enter into a relationship of love with him. And when the Ethiopian eunuch invites Philip into his chariot to explain the prophecies of Isaiah to him, a small crack is opened in the wall that divides the two of them. What we see in this story, and time again in Scripture, is that all God needs to work miracles is just a small crack to break through. The pivotal moment in this encounter is when the Ethiopian eunuch musters up just enough courage to ask Philip, "What is to prevent me from being baptized?" The language of this question is really important and cannot be overlooked, because the eunuch does not say, "Can you baptize me?" or "Will you baptize me?" He says, "What is to prevent me?" This person, because of every marker of his identity, has been cast aside and left out. He has lived a life where his personhood has prevented him from everything. He wants to know, what will it be this time that prevents him from joining the community? Thanks be to God, in that moment, Philip listens not to the shouts of the world, but to the whisperings of the Spirit. Nothing, absolutely nothing, is to prevent this man from being baptized. Now, the scriptural account leaves Philip speechless at this point, but his actions speak volumes. The chariot stops. They go to the water. Philip baptizes the eunuch. Philip is snatched away by the Spirit, and the eunuch goes home rejoicing that he has finally and fully been claimed as a beloved child of God. That, my friends, is what love, godly and holy love, looks like. When we allow the power of God's love to transform us, to bring us to places we do not wish to go, to force us to enter into relationships with people we do not want to encounter, love becomes incarnate. In concrete actions of witness, inclusion, and blessing, love becomes incarnate in God's unfailing grasp on each and every person as the barriers of fear that divide us come crashing down. That is the liberating message of love we hear today. And through that liberating love, we experience life and become community. Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, even though they will never see each other again or speak to one another again, are forever linked by the wilderness road. And through the waters of baptism, the Ethiopian eunuch has been grafted into the vineyard of God. When Jesus says in the gospel passage, "I am the vine and you are the branches," he is telling us about our role and place in community. Have you ever seen a vine grow? If you have, then you know there is nothing neat or orderly about it. The branches become an intertwined mess. It becomes nearly impossible to separate out one branch from another, nearly impossible to remove one branch without causing harm to another. This is what it means to be the community of the followers of Jesus. We are a glorious, imperfect, messy tangle of branches that lean on one another, that grow with one another, that rely on one another for our own survival. It's not lost on me that the overwhelming magnitude of this day falls just 1 week after the conclusion of the 100th anniversary celebration of this parish. As I think about the convergence of these lessons, the prophetic work of James Cone, and the life and witness of this community, I cannot help but wonder how God is calling this place to continue being a place of liberation for the margins of society. What places is God calling this community to get up and go to? Who are the people to be encountered on the wilderness road? Who are the next Ethiopian eunuchs to be grafted into the community? How is the Spirit's power shaking the Church of God right here on Hope Street? James Cone once wrote, "I speak and write out of a deep theological conviction that the true power of the Christian gospel is its unambiguous call for liberation from the forces of oppression and a fierce, unambiguous condemnation of those who oppress. In these years ahead, may these words be true of the Redeemer, that you speak, live, write, and embody the deep theological conviction that the true power of the gospel is its unambiguous call for liberation from the forces of oppression and a fierce, unambiguous condemnation of those who oppress. Amen."